Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, Counsel Thomas D. Donovan, Christopher D. Tease, on behalf of the appellant Ambrose L. Sykes. This appeal is a direct appeal from the Superior Court of the State of Delaware in Kent County after a trial and convictions of murder in the first degree and other serious felony charges. Would the court care for a brief recitation of the facts of the case?
It's probably fair to assume that we all know the facts, and if you simply relate those facts that are relevant to your legal argument as you make the legal argument, that will suffice.
Well, thank you, Chief Justice. In June of 2006, the jury trial commenced and concluded June 26, 2006, and at that time, closing arguments were scheduled before the matter was to go to the jury. The lower court gave an instruction to the jury that counsel would stand before them and give closing arguments, and at one point before the state actually stood up to make closing arguments, the court did instruct the jury that you also may be hearing from the defendant if he chooses to do what we call an allocution. It's entirely up to the defendant, and you may hear about that as we proceed. At this time, we're ready to proceed. The state gave a closing argument, and the court recessed. That time, counsel went back to chambers, and the defense requested a mistrial, which was denied. The judge in the lower court explained on the record that it needed to make a clarification on the record, a curative instruction, because he believed what he had commented to the jury was an error. Rather than readdress the allocution comment when the judge retook the bench, there was an instruction on the defendant's choice to testify or not to testify. And finally, there was a comment which obviously did not highlight the error in the allocution comment, but there was a comment by the court that said normally you would speculate as to what the defendant might have said, and he has exercised the right not if he had exercised his right to testify at trial. The appellant's argument is that the allocution comment amounts to a comment by the court on the defendant's right to testify or not to testify. As pointed out in United States versus Griffin, Griffin versus California. There are several factors we'd ask the court to consider, as outlined in the brief, as to why the comment was improper.
Now, when a judge instructs about the defendant's right to testify or not to testify, are you saying that's also a comment?
At the point in the proceeding, Justice Ridgely, the comment was made as though he was the jury instruction itself is not improper. That's well established that those comments are constitutional and are right. However, it's the context of the comment that the defendant was going to choose to testify or not at a point at a critical point actually of the proceedings where arguments were made, where the judge is instructing the jury to pay special attention to what each side was going to argue.
Well, if I understand the argument, it is that it created an expectation that the defendant would testify, which constitutes a comment by the court on his right to remain silent, and lead the jury to conclude that if he didn't say anything, he somehow implicates himself in a greater degree of guilt. Something along those lines is what constitutes the error. Let's assume that it was improper for the judge to say what he did. What you asked for was a mistrial, and he denied it. And the standard for the mistrial is you grant a mistrial when there's a manifest necessity in order to do justice. And if you don't grant the mistrial, we review it on the basis of abuse of discretion. So let's get right to it. How did the judge abuse his discretion by denying your motion for a mistrial?
Well, he decided to give a curative instruction, and rather than have arguments or have counsel argue each side, when clearly counsel should have been given an opportunity to be heard on whether or not there was a manifest injustice. We'd ask the court to also consider reviewing the entire circumstances for plain error. We think there's sufficient authority that when a Sixth Amendment or when any constitutional a right is violated, that it is a basis to reverse and remand for a new trial. I think that holding, the applicable holding in...
Well, tell us why the instruction was inadequate. Assuming there was a problem, why wasn't it cured by the instruction?
Well, there may have been two reasons. If the jury understood what the judge was saying in terms of allocution, they would have, there could have been an inference that the court had already decided the innocence or guilt of the defendant. If the jury understood that the next proceeding or the next phase would be an allocution and the court had improperly commented on the defendant's right to allocute himself. Now, of course, only would happen after the guilt phase. If the jury didn't understand what exactly allocution was, which I think is primarily, which was a basis for the denial of a new trial, there at least was a an expectation, as Chief Justice Steele pointed out, that the Mr. Sykes was going to stand up and do something. I think the exact words were, "You may be hearing from the defendant." So he was going to stand up and say something. The curative instruction merely it highlighted the fact that a defendant has a right not to testify or testify as he chooses, but doesn't clarify what allocution is or what the defendant has a right to do or not do in terms of allocution. So instead of clarifying that allocution is not going to happen at this stage, just kind of highlighted the expectation that the defendant was going to testify or not testify, and obviously he wasn't going to testify because the evidence had already been submitted. And
well, if there had been clarification of what allocution meant, wouldn't that have exacerbated the problem? That is, why is it prejudicial that there was no reference in the curative instruction to allocution?
Our request, there was our request. That was the predicament we were in at that point, because you keep bringing up the same point that obviously we didn't want the jury to dwell on or to have it highlighted. We asked the court to include another instruction, which could have been given, we thought was proper at the time, to kind of diffuse that prejudice we felt was going to be there once he commented on the allocution part. But we thought we might combine it with another insignificant or non-issue.
Well, you suggested that he didn't give you a chance to point out alternatives because you had no argument on it, but you did submit an alternative instruction, and he chose not to give it. Did he say why?
Well, what had happened is after the arguments, it was at the end of the day, after arguments were concluded, the jury was sequestered, and we came back the following morning, and the state and the defense on the record decided that a new instruction should be given. And we were on the record discussing the instruction, and the jury, of course, had returned a verdict before the court had an opportunity to re-instruct the jury. So the court was willing to give the instruction, but, of course, we never had the opportunity to do so. Of course, we thought that might help. It wasn't our first position in what we requested, but the state, I think, certainly conceded that there was error in that the first curative instruction wasn't sufficient to cover all bases.
You're saying the state agreed that the curative instruction that the court did wasn't sufficient?
On the record, that's what the state's position was. We had agreed that we would re-instruct the jury before they commenced or concluded deliberations.
Do you have a citation for that?
That would be in the
In the appendix, I assume?
Yes. Can I retrieve that?
Sure.
I thought the state's position was the instruction could have been improved upon, but not that it was defective.
That may very well have been how it was presented on the record.
Well, here's,
not to mistake.
Here's what I have, if it helps. The prosecutor stated, Your Honor is going to tell them the defendant's right not to testify instruction. I think they have to know that he can't allocute on the defense's statement. Not that he's chosen not to or doesn't want to, but that you misspoke and that he cannot do so. Because if there is any expectation on his part that he can say something, that could be a problem. I think you need to tell them that he can't. Instead of that, what the trial judge chose to do is just give the dry, no comment on whether he testifies or doesn't testify, he has a right to testify or not to testify. Never define what allocution meant, which I doubt the average juror would have a clue what allocution meant in the abstract. Nor did he say he had misspoke when he led them to believe that the defendant had a right to talk and might exercise the right to or not to. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's where the prosecutor agreed with you that what he did was not far enough.
Correct.
That's not the position the state takes now, however, you understand.
Yes. But as, yeah, at the time, that was the discussion and that was the request. It was more or less, how I remember, a joint request to have a new instruction given to the jury.
But if it is something I didn't grasp from the record for some reason. The jury came back with a verdict before this got addressed further?
Yes.
How long was the jury out?
Approximately 30 minutes. This was 9:30 in the morning, essentially, when everything was on the record. We did file motions, and we did ask the court to on several different occasions to reconsider its prior rulings and to grant the defendant below a new trial. Not to belabor the point, but I think the Stewart-Caballero test, while it applies to prosecutors or state's attorneys in commenting on the accused's right to testify or not testify, is applicable here. As I said, we would argue that when the court comments on such a privilege, the only cure is to reverse and remand for a new trial, because it's so much more grave or important when a judge speaks than the attorneys at that stage. So we think there is a heightened scrutiny.
Let me make a suggestion. You're more than halfway through your argument now, and you might want to address the Batson issue.
Thank you. As the jury selection began, it was a long process, 4 or 5 days. The 6 of the first 12 jurors from the pool that were presented to the court were stricken by the state on a peremptory basis, and 4 out of those 12 were black jurors. The essential pool was 100 people, the first pool. We actually ran over that. There was a total of, I believe, 16 black jurors at that point. So the roughly 16% of the jury pool was black. Of the six peremptories used, 66, or I'm sorry, of the total number of peremptories used by the state, 66% of them were for black jurors, which is a significant number given the number of blacks that were available. After the fifth peremptory was used, which would have been in the third black juror, the defense did raise a Batson challenge, and the state did provide a basis for 3 of the challenges. At that point, the court concluded its inquiry rather than turning back to the defense to provide a basis or to show why there was racial or improper motivations for striking the jury. So essentially the court was incomplete in its analysis. We argue that the Batson requires the court to do a more thorough inquiry into the reasons for the
Did you tell the trial judge that Batson was a three and not a two-step analysis at the time?
I don't believe that we went into that point. There was comment about a reverse Batson possibility, which was on the record and highlighted in the state's brief, and that was sort of the end of the discussion at that point. So I don't believe we even got into the analysis of Batson during the jury selection. I would point out that the eight of the potential black jurors were removed for cause, and the defense did agree, I believe, with at least seven of them that they should be removed for cause, and we only opposed one being removed for cause, and we did also exercise a peremptory on one black juror just to address any reverse Batson issues. And I would point out that two of the first three blacks stricken did have criminal charges, or at least one of them had criminal charges. At least one of the white jurors had a conviction, and at least three of the or two of the jurors and one alternate had criminal records, arrests, or convictions. And that was one of the main bases for the state.
Well, let's assume there's a Batson violation. What is your suggested remedy?
Our suggestion would be to have a new panel and have a new trial. Have it reversed and remanded for a new trial.
Well, didn't the judge here, the trial judge, essentially skip the first step, but assume that a prima facie case is shown based on the numbers that you provided? He found that the reasons were race neutral under the second step. And on the third step, he said, I have to conclude that I don't think it's there. Wasn't he referring to purposeful discrimination when he said that?
He did. Yes, I think he did conclude that, but I think it was without input or turning back to the defense to provide a basis to overcome the presumption that it was race neutral. So I think his analysis was incomplete.
You're arguing that the defense was deprived of an opportunity to show that the state's reasons for exercising the peremptories was pretextual?
That's correct.
And the judge made a ruling before the defense was had any opportunity to do that?
That's correct. That's our position.
Was an objection made at the time on that basis?
I don't think the record reflects that.
Was not then?
Yeah. Not that I recall.
So we're talking about plain error?
At this point, yes. We did.
I'm unclear on this. Was all of the argument presented and then he made these comments, or there was things that you wanted to say that you were cut off?
There was no, this sort of happened in the flow of the jury selection. There was no real pause in discussion. It maybe it was a 15-minute argument in the courtroom. It was not revisited for a couple of days. I believe later we made a written motion, or we readdressed it towards the conclusion of the jury selection. But no, we didn't actually present any significant argument or perform any analysis at that point.
You're saying that later you made a written Batson motion?
I don't know if we submitted. I don't know if we submitted it, Justice Jacobs.
It was a renewed motion.
We renewed the motion at the conclusion of the jury selection. I'm sure of that, and we did ask the court to reconsider its prior ruling at that point. Once we had a chance to go back and review Batson and. What we thought was, we didn't have all the statistics or anything like that in front of us at the time.
Well, in renewing your motion, did you say everything you wanted to say?
I believe so at that point.
And then the trial judge denied it?
Yes, he did deny it.
You're now in your rebuttal time. Did you want to save it?
Yes, I'd like to save that time.
Mr. Donovan, before you sit down, you can tell me the answer when you come back. But you're representing the defendant in a direct appeal and an automatic appeal, and you didn't address proportionality in your opening brief. This court's never seen that before. And then when you had it addressed by the state in its answering brief and you filed your reply brief, you still didn't address the issue of proportionality. So the court would be interested in knowing why you didn't address the issues that are mandated in the automatic appeal that our court has to decide.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. May it please the court. I'll attempt to address the first two issues that have been raised on appeal, but, of course, if the court has any questions about any of the other three or four arguments, I'll certainly attempt to answer those as well. The first argument concerns the allocution reference, and in this case it arose in the context of the closing arguments. The trial judge made actually a fairly brief reference to the right of allocution. Of course, it was misplaced. The defendant does not have a right to allocute at the guilt phase in a capital proceeding, but he does have the right during the penalty phase, if in fact there is a penalty phase, after the guilt phase is concluded. The trial judge realized this mistake relatively promptly. There was an adjournment, I believe, after the state's closing argument to chambers. The trial judge indicated at that time to counsel that he had gotten ahead of himself. He acknowledged that he had made a mistake in raising that issue, and he then proposed to go ahead and give a curative instruction. The curative instruction given is basically the statement that the defendant does not have any responsibility to testify and that a jury is to draw no adverse inference from the fact that a defendant does not speak at his criminal prosecution. They're not to infer guilt from silence, in other words. The issue was raised by the defense in the context of a mistrial application. That was what the judge had to decide from the defendant's point of view. They were requesting that a mistrial be declared. At that point, all of the evidence had been heard. Closing arguments were proceeding. So the judge had to decide, in the exercise of his discretion, whether or not there was a manifest necessity, as this court's already noted today, to grant a mistrial. In other words, were the ends of public justice going to be otherwise defeated if the trial was not aborted at this point? State's position is that the trial judge did not abuse his discretion in denying the mistrial application here. A mistrial is only appropriate when there are no other meaningful or practical alternatives to that. What the trial judge did by giving the curative instruction was an appropriate response under the particular circumstances. There was further...
Mr. Williams, yes. Let's assume that a curative instruction might have been an acceptable alternative. And tell us why this one was effective, in particular in light of the state's comments about what might have been a better way to say it. It seems that in the timing of this was the judge suggested you're about to hear closing arguments, you're going to hear from the prosecution, the defense, and perhaps the defendant. And the judge realized that was incorrect. And it seems that what the state was suggesting before the jury came back with its verdict is that perhaps you should have told them, I suggested you may hear from the defense, the defendant, at this point in the trial, but that was incorrect. The defendant doesn't have a right or an opportunity to speak at this point in the proceedings, or something to that effect.
Yes, no, I think that's exactly the context. The statement itself that started all this was starts at A85 and goes on to A86 in the appendix, and he says, you also may be hearing from the defendant if he chooses to do what we call an allocution. It's entirely up to the defendant, and you may hear about that as we proceed. And then after the counsel adjourned to chambers, the trial judge came back, and that's when he told the jury about the defendant's election not to testify. And that pretty much mirrors the general instruction that's given when a defendant doesn't testify.
My question is, all the evidence was closed. The case was done, and so there was not going to be an opportunity to testify. So when you suggest the defendant's not going to testify, that really wasn't where we were in the proceeding. It was the closing arguments.
Correct. And then I think that's what generated the concern the following morning when both counsel were speaking with the trial judge. I think it starts in the appendix around A100 or 102. There's a discussion there, and one of the prosecutors is talking about at the bottom of A102. Mr. Wells says only the attorneys have the right to address the jury during closing argument. There's some follow-up discussion after that, and then the judge says at the bottom of A109, the court, first of all, the court did indicate on the record that the court misspoke. I think the prosecutor was asking the judge to frame an additional supplemental instruction that he had misspoken. And the trial judge says, well, the court did indicate on the record that the court misspoke. In rethinking this, this is the trial judge now, and this was discussed both by myself and the other judges, we felt it was not appropriate for me to go in and say that it was an error. That's why, at the top of A105, I chose the words carefully, that I misspoke. That's exactly what I did when I brought you back in chambers. And he's talking about the preceding day. I indicated that I simply got a little ahead of myself. And I think the reason why I didn't focus on, quote, allocution, close quote, was simply because you just said, Mr. Donovan, that I would be refocusing the jury's attention on the word allocution. So that's why the judge decides not to use the word allocution, that he's concerned about exacerbating the situation by bringing up the word again.
Moving beneath the word allocution, which, as the Chief Justice pointed out, most jurors probably would not understand in the abstract, aren't we talking here about a difference between telling the jury, on the one hand, that they weren't going to hear from the defendant because he had no right to testify at this stage, and telling the jury that they weren't going to be hearing from the defendant because he had chosen not to testify, and the jury should not give that any weight or significance?
Well, I think that's
that element of choice. The argument would go that element of choice still lingered on as a result of what the judge either said or didn't say to the jury. And that's the reason why there was manifest necessity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think certainly the element of choice may have lingered on. I think that's what's prompting the prosecution's questions, or at least colloquy with the court the next morning. However, the instruction is, and the jury's presumed to follow the court's instructions, that they were to draw no negative inference from that. They were not to assume that the defendant was guilty. And I think that's about as far as you can go with however you craft the instruction, whether you put allocution in or don't, or say misspoke or not.
Am I correct that the trial court said to the jury, I got ahead of myself, in referring to allocution?
No, I think he said that in chambers to counsel. He didn't say that to the jury, I don't believe. I think it's A95 and 96 in there somewhere.
Yeah, I think when you were referring to the trial judge saying that he misspoke on the record, it wasn't before the jury. It may have been on the record with counsel present, but the jury never heard that he misspoke.
No, I don't think he said – I don't think he used the word misspoke, and he didn't use the word allocution in front of the jury.
And as I understand the transcript, at least A89 suggests a point in time to me before he gave the instruction on the defendant's right not to testify, and the prosecutor urged him to do more than that because there was a problem. And the prosecutor identified the problem is the expectation that the defendant can say something. That could be a problem. I think you need to tell them that he can't, and he never did.
No, he didn't. He didn't say that. And then the question, I think, boils down to, and that's, I think the prosecutor was obviously being very cautious here, and more cautious than he needed to be. It isn't a Griffin violation under these circumstances. Griffin versus California was a sort of unique case in that California actually had a statute that said that the jury could be instructed if the defendant didn't testify that, you know, negative inferences could be drawn from that. That's the thrust of the constitutional claim here, whether or not you're commenting on the exercise of the right to remain silent or not. Here, the jury is specifically told not to draw any adverse inference, and I think given alternatives that are available, certainly the state would have preferred maybe a broader instruction, but the jury came back so quickly in this case, there wasn't an opportunity to do that.
Well, that's where I'm confused. Help me out here. According to my record, and it may be wrong, says you were quoting from the appendix page 100 plus.
Yes.
A89 is when the prosecutor says, even before the trial judge chose to give the curative instruction about right not to testify, the prosecutor urged him to do more than that because he believed that that alone was inadequate.
Yes,
isn't that correct?
Yeah, yes, that's correct. And that happened the day the comment occurred, and then
The jury went out.
Yes, and it was reiterated the next day. But the fact that the judge didn't do more is not a fatal constitutional violation here, especially when you're talking about the way the claim was framed by the defense. What the defense wanted was kind of all or nothing. They wanted to abort the trial right now, declare a mistrial, even though we've sat through 6 days of jury instruction.
But look at 89, after what the Chief Justice showed you, the court says if he testifies, he's waiving his right. Then the prosecutor says, but that's passed. The court, that's passed. The prosecutor, he can't speak during this portion, during the closing summation. The defendant cannot speak. Then the court says, I think I have to give a clarification. I don't think there's any question about that. But one thing the clarification doesn't include is to tell the jury, I misspoke when I suggested the defendant had a right to speak.
No, he doesn't say that.
Was there any, when he gave the curative instruction, was there any exception made to it?
I don't think there was. There was some discussion back and forth the next day, but again, nothing was really subject to a judicial ruling the next day because of the intervening jury verdict. So I don't recall there being an explicit defense exception.
A96 shows that as soon as the instruction ended, it ended with this statement from the judge, all right, at this time we will hear from Mr. Donovan for the defense. And then the defense started its closing argument.
Yes, I think that's what happened.
Did the trial judge instruct the jury at any point that anything that he said or did during the trial is not to be construed as any opinion on the guilt or innocence of the defendant?
I don't recall if there was such an instruction. That's usually a form instruction that is given. It's usually given in the context of the final instructions to the jury during guilt phase. I don't know if that specific instruction was given or not, but frequently it is. I've seen it a number of times, and it's usually one of the standard instructions that's given, that they're not to draw any adverse inference from any questions the court may have asked or any statements that the judge has, and that I think it goes on to say he's completely impartial and has no favoritism toward either side. It's a general kind of generic instruction, but it usually is given. I just don't recall if it was given here or not.
I usually don't cross-examine counsel on the exact words that they use, but you did argue, I think, that there was no, and I'm quoting now, fatal constitutional error. Assuming you didn't misspeak, did you mean that there's no constitutional error, period, or that there may have been a constitutional error, but it was harmless?
No, I think here there isn't any constitutional error, and it's not fatal. Probably my words are not ideally chosen, but that's what I mean.
Well,
it's not
there's no constitutional error at all with or without any curative instruction, or there's no constitutional error, and it was appropriate to deny the motion for a mistrial because it wasn't abuse of discretion. And the reason for all that, bottom line, is that the curative instruction that the trial judge actually gave was what we refer to as meaningful, practical, and an adequate alternative to declaring a mistrial?
Yes. I think the judge, what he did was sufficient.
And that's why there's no constitutional error, not because his comment wasn't improper in the first place.
Well, see, this is not as egregious a case as Griffin. I mean, Griffin, the judge told him, pursuant to a California statute, that if he doesn't get on the stand, you can draw adverse inferences. Well, he didn't say that. He just said he may, if he chooses, allocute. So it was more of a voluntary decision at that point. Of course,
but
it was a practical matter.
But the advice he was giving the jury was erroneous, was it not?
Well, that was,
it was incorrect.
Yes.
So there was an error.
Well, yes,
kind.
And it's a question of whether it's constitutional error or not. In the state's position, it is not constitutional error. And looking at it in the context of the mistrial, that what the judge did, while the state would have preferred he had chosen some additional language, was still sufficient to cure any possible defect here.
Does it make any difference that the court itself said, and this is before it made its comments, on page A93, the court said, I'll say, in terms of what I'm going to say to clarify, because he says, I do think it would be reversible error if I don't correct the record right now, so I'll give that instruction. I'll say that there is no right for the defendant to speak to the jury, and the court will admit it was an error on the part of the court, and I'll reiterate and restate the defendant's right not to testify. And then the court didn't do that.
Well, I didn't do all of it, and you know, that's what he said to counsel, and then they went back and he gave an instruction, and then after that, I guess that gave some additional pause to the trial prosecutors, and the next morning they and the defense counsel both raised the issue, and everyone was discussing it, and suddenly the jury came back with a verdict that morning.
Well, I guess the reason I'm raising it is because it seems as if the defense counsel, the state, and the trial court all took the same position, which was the jury has to be told that what I said before was a mistake and that the defendant didn't have a right to say anything at that point, at the allocution comment. And then the court didn't do it. And we're just supposed to, at this point, say that was harmless or not an error or a sufficiently curative statement. When it's not even, when none of the parties thought that was good enough?
Well, everybody may have been on board the boat at one point, but I guess by the time it got to the dock, the judge had changed his mind or whatever, because that's not exactly what he said when the jury is back in the courtroom.
It almost sounds like what you read to us, that he went back in the chambers, talked to the other judges, and the consensus was judges don't admit that they make mistakes, so don't do that.
Well, I don't know about that, but he at least,
I don't know about it either, but I'm worried about it since you read earlier that he went back and talked to other judges.
Well, he does say that on the record, and I think he was consulting with other members of the judiciary and decided that referencing allocution specifically was going to be problematic, and he didn't say that he had misspoke, although at one point he indicated that he was going to say something to that effect, but did not.
And the record reflects that after all of that happened, the next day when the jury was deliberating, the state was still concerned that what the judge had done was incomplete.
Well, I think that's true, and it's a question of whether the state was being overcautious or not, and the bottom line is, was this defendant deprived of his right to a fair trial? Was his right to remain silent, his constitutional right, somehow infringed by this brief reference to the right of allocution? It's the state's position that it was not, and that the curative instruction, while it could have been certainly more inclusive and included additional terms that at one point seemingly everybody was in agreement probably should be done, was still sufficient to cure the problem in this context.
Well, he did say he misspoke when he instructed the jury. At A94, and didn't he, in essence, substitute the instruction that should have been given the day before without referring to allocution?
Well, I'm not. I didn't think he said he misspoke, but he may.
I want to clarify one thing because I misspoke. Line 14 and 15.
No, he does say I misspoke. You're correct, Your Honor. And that's looks like that's the afternoon when he's given the curative instruction there. That's kind of the preface at the very beginning above where he talks about it. So I think it may not have been as clear as the state would have liked. It didn't include a reference to allocution, but I think even the defense was acknowledging that that was going to be problematic to start talking about allocution. The trial judge himself says it's a legal term. Probably most of the jurors don't know what allocution really means. If I don't have to get into it at this point, I'm not going to. The second issue that's been argued today concerns the Batson problem here. The state, when the Batson challenge was specifically raised on the fourth morning of jury selection was approximately 6 days here, at that point had exercised, I think, three of their five peremptory challenges to exclude minority potential jurors. The defendant was a black a male. The victim was a white female in this case. This court's standard of review is de novo. Here, the state gave race-neutral explanations for the three challenged peremptories that had been used at that point. The trial judge, I think, has already been pointed out, kind of skipped the first step, and state went right into giving the race-neutral explanations for why they challenged Mr. Stevens, Ms. Talley, and then there was another lady who was a youth counselor, Ms. Flith. And the explanations the state submits were certainly race-neutral. That's what the trial judge found here. Mr. Stevens was challenged. He was the first African-American individual who was struck because he had a criminal record for offensive touching.
But the claim is that, after those race-neutral explanations were proffered, the defense was entitled to show that those race-neutral explanations were pretextual and they were deprived of that right.
Well, I don't know if they were deprived of it. I don't know that they asserted that right. I mean, the argument being made on appeal is that the trial judge didn't follow the tripartite, the three-step Batson analysis here, and that he didn't fully explicate on the third step here. The trial judge probably or certainly did short-circuit some of it. I mean, he's pretty much skipped the first step entirely.
What should we do under that circumstance? You recall in the Jones case there was a remand?
Yes.
And the Third Circuit's made it pretty clear that either the Superior Court or this court has to engage in the three-part analysis, and that if the Superior Court doesn't do it, this court has to do it on appeal.
Yes.
So those are the two choices if it wasn't done. For our court to do it independently, or we need to remand it to the Superior Court?
Well, I think that's entirely up to this court. You do have a de novo standard of review, so this court can, in fact, go back and look through. I think what the judge did say was kind of a parenthetical totality of the circumstances comment, but he does make a passing reference that, you know, given the reasons that the state has set forth here, he doesn't see that any of this has to do with racial classifications or categories, that there were other bona fide reasons. And looking at the context of this, I think that's really what the third step is in the total context, the facts and circumstances in particular cases are pretext.
Well, isn't that the problem, though? Depends on what one means by the total context. If you don't turn to the defense and then say, now that you as well as I have heard the prosecutor give race-neutral reasons, I want to hear from you what facts or factors suggest to you that they were otherwise ill-motivated and that these are simply superficial reasons or whatever. Then he takes from the defense what the defense can make of that. Then in the analysis, he balances the prosecutor's proffered reasons that are race-neutral. He looks at what the defense offers to suggest they are not, and then he makes his final conclusion. And that's what the Third Circuit has impressed upon us in the most difficult of circumstances, is as Justice Holland referred, that's something that has to be done in the first instance by the Superior Court or by us when we have a record that allows us to do it. Now, if you miss the part of the third step that includes the defense, in effect, attempting to rebut the prosecution's proffered race-neutral reasons, how could we do it?
Well, I think you can do it in this case because they've had the opportunity on appeal and looking at all this to raise this. And what they've said is that, well, the problem, Mr. Stevens, is there were some other white jurors who were not peremptorily challenged by the state that had criminal records. They've not made any specific response about Kisha Talley, who was a fairly young lady, and the state indicated they were not sure of how seriously she appreciated the gravity of the thing. Ms. Flith was the youth counselor who said she didn't judge her clients, and the state thought that was problematic. So defense has really only argued about Mr. Stevens, and they've had the opportunity and appeal to do that. I think you can either do it de novo, or if the court thinks that a more in-depth analysis is required from the trial judge who actually sat there, can be remanded for that limited purpose. If there's any other questions, I'll try to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you again.
Why don't you help us out by beginning with Justice Holland's last point. If there is a failure to perform the three-step Batson analysis for the sake of argument, what, if anything, do we do about it? Is the record complete enough for us to decide it, or should it be remanded for the trial judge?
We don't think the record is complete, although we did address more than just the criminal records in the appeal. Also, we did point out that there were other factors that shouldn't have played in for the race-neutral comments. Most people were a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10. That was a question that was thrown out there to every juror. How do you fall on the imposition of death penalty, 1 to 10? And one of the reasons the state provided was that one of the jurors was unsure. She said 5, and then she said a 4 when asked the next question, and that line of questioning is in the statement of facts.
Is that a pattern voir dire question now, a scale of 1 to 10?
Well, that's
where did that come from?
That's the first time I've heard of that and seen that.
Well, did you ask for it?
No.
Did the state ask for it?
Not that I know of. I don't think that anyone asked for that instruction. The or that line of questioning, the voir dire was rather lengthy and somewhat repetitive, and the selection process did go, I think, longer than was anticipated. At one point, the state and the defense did agree to ask the judge to excuse some jurors, potential jurors, for cause because of the lengthy questioning and some of the responses, but we did not ask for that, and I don't think the state asked for that 1 to 10, but that pretty much everyone was 5, and that was one of the reasons that that the one juror was excused. And
tell me the answer to my earlier question about how you represent a defendant in a capital murder appeal that mandates proportionality review, and you never address it in either your opening brief or your reply brief.
Quite simply, Justice Holland, we had several issues that we reviewed and tried to present the strongest arguments. There was a series of events and other legal questions or legal motions that were denied at the court below that we didn't raise on appeal.
This isn't optional. There's a statutory mandate that says if nobody wants to raise any issue on appeal, we have to address proportionality. So in every capital murder case, one issue that has to be addressed, and perhaps the only issue that has to be addressed, even if you want to waive all of your other issues on appeal, is proportionality.
I can't answer that other than that we chose to present the strongest, what we thought the strongest arguments were, and that we addressed, I guess we're in a position where our client's involved in a class action where eventually the death penalty in the state of Delaware may be reviewed. we raised, or at least raised some of the arguments that are being decided in district court at this time, and we thought perhaps that was the best argument to proceed with at this stage in this court. That's all I guess I can speak to on that point. I understand the court's position in asking that question. If there's nothing else,
all right, thank you.
I'm complete.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.